You're listening to WRFI, Watkins Glen, Ithaca, and this is the Made of Clay Report. Our guest on this episode is Linda P. Saunders. Linda, it's good to have you here.
It's good to be here, Eric.
So, Linda, the way the show begins is with just a huge question, and you can take it lots of different ways, but what do we need to, who are you, and what do we need to know about the qualities you aspire to live by, or what you've done, or what you're doing? What do we need to know to start this conversation?
Well, let's start at the very beginning. I was born in Harvey, Illinois. Well, actually, I was raised in Harvey, Illinois. I was born in Blue Island, Illinois, and both are suburbs of Chicago. So I grew up in the Chicagoland area, and I am the second child of Lee and Rena Christian. I am a twin sister. I have an older sister. I have a younger sister, and I have two younger brothers. So there are six of us.
Wow.
And I always say I enjoy growing up in a family of that size. A lot of times people think six. It seems like a shock, but it was actually fun. We had our own, we could pick up a few neighbors, and we had our baseball team, and we had our basketball team, and we enjoy playing together. And my parents were actually, they're the anchors, that they're the reason that I am where I am today. They gave me a solid foundation. Whenever I have a chance to give them kudos to them or props, I do so. They are now both octogenarians, but my life values, my life calling, my life my world views were shaped growing up in their home. And so while I might not, I didn't think of it when I was a child, but looking back, I see the profundity of my parents' wisdom. I can still hear my mother saying, anybody can roll down a hill, but it takes effort to climb up a hill. And in essence, she was saying, don't follow the crowd, be courageous, be different, and demonstrate prudence in both word and action. And that sticks with me today. Mm-hmm. My father, while he's not much of a talker, but his actions spoke loud and clear. And as far as a work ethic, I don't think I've met anybody in this world with such an impeccable work ethic. And my father always said, the best way to hit the jackpot is to get up every morning and go to work. Yep. So, and he demonstrated this until his retirement. I think he retired in 1998 or 1999. I don't quite remember.
What's the age span between your youngest and oldest siblings?
The age band. Okay. My oldest sister is, I think, 12 and a half years older than my youngest brother. And there's a 6.5 year gap, I think, between myself and my older sister. Of course, my twin sister, I'm 4 minutes older.
Let the record show.
Right. So, then between them, this Lisa and I, and then our brother is, I think, right at 3 years younger. And then our younger siblings are a little less than 2 years apart.
Right, right. Neat. You were kind of bunched together there on the latter half of that, though.
On the latter, yes.
somebody had a child, had free childcare a little bit from the oldest sibling.
I always thought that was cool growing up, but then when I began to have children, it didn't seem so cool to have them that close together.
That's right. Yep. Yep. I get it. What made the environment of the home that you grew up in so rich for your learning?
My mother, both my parents, my mother and my father were raised in what I consider a very godly, happy home, conservative home, loving home. They were both, while they were conservative, but they allowed us to grow, and they valued education at a level that I'm not sure if everyone values it to their, I'm sure they're not, you know, people value education, but the value that they put on education was priceless for us. And I say that because my mother, she has her high school degree, and my father has his high school degree, and he did some years at a community college, and he went on to become a McDonald's owner operator. So he did the McDonald's program and graduated from Hamburger University. But they valued education,
right?
And they instilled in us those principles, and to the point where I was at Purdue University, which is where I graduated with my undergraduate degree, but I was at Purdue University before I realized that people had options after high school that did not include college.
Right.
I really thought that you went from high school to college and there was no exceptions.
Right.
So, you know, this will sound strange, I'm sure, but that is really, you know, it was, we went through school, and from the time I can remember, we all talked about what we were majoring in at college, what our degrees would be in, and all my siblings, we all have our undergraduate degree, and I think almost every one of us has a master's degree. And I have earned my PhD, and I have a brother working on a doctoral degree. But the value of education placed in our home was priceless. My mother took us to the libraries, to museums. When we went on vacation, we had fun and time to swim and all that, and, you know, time to go to the beach. But I look back in our vacations, our family vacations were like a teaching tool.
Sure.
The home was really nurtured holistically.
When you said they instilled in you the value of education, it sound, and what I hear in that is that they instilled in you the discipline of curiosity, not just consumerism, not just, you know, going out for experience's sake. But this has to add up to something. It has to build on something. And I get it. So what would you like to begin musically with today? What would you like to open the show?
I talk about my parents a lot. And I certainly, I'm eternally grateful. I always tell them, even at this age, at my age now, if I had a choice, if life started back over and I had a choice, I would choose Lee and Rena Christian for my parents. And I want to give them a shout out. They will celebrate 63 years of marriage on December 24th of this year. And so the first song I think I like to play is by Celine Dion, Because You Loved Me.
For all those times you stood by me, for all the truth that you made me see, for all the joy you brought to my life, for all the wrong that you made right, for every dream you made come true, for all the love I found in you, I'll be forever thankful, baby. You're the one who held me up, never let me fall. You're out of reach, you stood by me. Each day you gave me, maybe I You were my strength.
You were my voice when I couldn't speak.
You were my eyes when I couldn't see. You saw the best there was in me. Lifted me up when I couldn't reach. You gave me faith 'cause you believed. I'm everything I am because you loved me.
You're listening to WRFI, Watkins Glen, Ithaca, and this is the Made of Clay Report. Our guest on this episode is Linda P. Saunders. What did you have to learn to know how to live yourself the life you value?
That is an excellent question, Eric. And the one thing that I believe my parents sheltered us from is the racism in the world and the racism that exist in the United States. And I know it's a subject, sometimes people shy away from it, but I'm not sure when I realized that racism exists. And what I mean by that, we had experiences as youth. We went to a predominantly African-American elementary school and junior high school. But we moved to Indianapolis, Indiana from the Chicagoland area when I was in high school. So for my high school years, I went to high school that was 95-96% white. And while I had moved a bit in and out of the white environment, we went to, growing up in Chicago, the YMCA that we took swimming lessons from and different lessons, gymnastics and all that, was a predominantly white environment. But arriving in Indianapolis to a high school that was overwhelmingly white began to open my eyes to this idea of racism in the United States. So we experienced some things that my parents then began to explain, you know. And of course, in the home, I remember hearing my parents talk about different things, but in my mind, as a young child, it didn't relate to someone did this because this is a racist action or this is, you know, the system that we're living under. But once I came to, once we arrived in Indianapolis and the different things I experienced for myself, I began to realize that, and of course, looking back over life, I realized that as young children, my parents sheltered us from that world because growing up in the 60s and 70s, it was volatile times.
Yes.
Spiritually speaking, but I wasn't as aware then. You know, I look back, and that actually is what I do. I study and research African-American history and United States history. But I think back, wow, I was actually living during these times and was not as aware that this is what was going on. Now, I remember begging my father to let us go with him to hear Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. speak. He had come to Chicago. But as a, you know, this is, I'm talking about a real small child. So all I know is that I've heard Dr. Martin Luther King's name. I keep hearing this name. And I know that my father was going to hear him and he was taking my older sister. So I wanted to go. But beyond that, I wasn't aware of the profound issues that were at stake. And so that I have learned through the years. Of course, you know, growing up in America, we have a lot of things to overcome. Right. And
so how did being sheltered from those issues help your development, your sense of personal agency and your personal development? And how may it have, well, what were the effects, positive or negative, from that of being sheltered?
You know, the positive effects are that you don't have this built up animosity or resentment or bitterness. And that's something that I consciously work towards. I don't want to be resentful. I don't want to be bitter because of the racial inequality that exists in our nation. So being sheltered in that sense was good. But sometimes I think that some things need to trickle out age appropriate, but
right.
Even young children should be aware that, you know, if someone does this, this action could indicate this.
Right.
And I think that on everybody or something that happens, but I still remember I was in junior high and I never told my parents, actually, that I wasn't in junior high. I was a freshman in high school. And I told my parents almost everything that happened at school or whatever, but this particular incident, I don't ever remember telling them. But I still remember the day that one of my classmates called me the N-word. And of course, we were recent to Indianapolis. And so having a completely different environment, I didn't even know how to react to that. And that's probably why I didn't say anything to my parents, because in my mind, I'm thinking, is this an isolated incident or is this how these people behave? You know, I didn't right. know which way to go with that. But yeah, it can. There are positive and negative effects to that.
But what I hear is that what your first reaction was, I need to understand where this is coming from, and I need to be able to react accordingly.
Mm-hmm. That was my first reaction. Yes.
Right, and you didn't take it back to your parents because you hadn't discussed those kinds of things with them directly. Yet is what
directly,
I'm inferring.
Yeah. No. Yeah. Right. Not yeah. directly. I mean, we know that we discuss things that happened. We always, one thing my parents did, my mother, I was blessed to have a home. I mean, like this, I look back on it. But every morning, my mother got up and made breakfast for us every morning. Every evening, we ate dinner together. So at the dinner table, that's a prime opportunity to have all kind of discussions. And that's what we did. I mean, we laughed, we talked, we had disagreements. So, you know, certain things were said, certain things were not said. We could see if something came on TV. Sometimes it was a teaching moment. Sometimes I remember certain things coming on TV and my mother wanting to turn the TV off. So my parents used wisdom and they used what knowledge that, you know, they used what they had at that time to navigate the waters that we were living in.
Did they change their stance toward you once you moved to the Indianapolis area?
My parents?
Yeah, did they change their stance about how they talked with you once you were outside of the more exclusively Black African-American community in Chicago?
You know, the older we got, the more we engaged, especially with my father, the more I would engage with in conversations like that with him.
So that made him talk?
Yes, I think so, because we began to have different experiences that we hadn't had prior to moving to Indianapolis.
Yeah, because you said he was kind of quiet, didn't say much.
He's a quiet man, but
yeah, no, but on those issues, he stood up and talked. Yeah.
He talks when my father speaks, we usually stop and listen, because it's one of those things that he's not just going to talk to talk, but when he talks, he definitely has something to say. So, yeah.
So how did you make sense of the N-word used in Indianapolis toward you?
You know, these are experiences that you put it out of your mind at the time, but then as you go through life, you begin to say, okay, this is, and maybe that, for me, this is how I handle things. So when I look back on certain things, I'm like, okay, this happened. This young man was upset. He hadn't made the football team. I remember the incident. And we were into a conversation about the football team and just, you know, sports in general. And at the time I played basketball and ran track and was one of the, actually I had a record at the high school that stood for a while. So I was one of the better athletes. And I think that is what was eating at him.
Right.
So out of his anger, he didn't know any other way. And now I look back, I'm sure that word was used at home. And, you know, it was something that he was probably used to hearing. You know, we were not far from the KKK headquarters in southern Indiana, which was a few minutes south of Indianapolis. So these kind of things, you look back and say, okay, we were navigating and maneuvering with people that were not fond of being around African Americans at all. Right. But it's, you know, I've learned that's, unfortunately, it's life in America.
Right. Let's cut to music. What would you like to play at this particular juncture?
I think a good one right now might be Marvin Gaye's Ain't No Mountain High Enough. I think of this one, my family was my anchor. And even now, I mean, with my husband, I mean, that's my anchor is still my family, my faith, my God. And when I think about this song, Ain't No Mountain High Enough, sung by Marvin Gaye, I think about my family and our relationship to each other and how we're there always for each other.
There in a hurry, you don't have to worry, 'cause baby, there
You're listening to WRFI, Watkins Glen, Ithaca, and this is the Made of Clay Report. Our guest on this episode is Linda P. Saunders. How have things worked out differently than you anticipated they would, whether better or worse?
Okay. Well, for the better, but what I would say is what life has taught me is that human nature is worldwide, human nature is human nature. We have different cultures, there's different languages, there's different tribes and ethnicities, but human nature is the same no matter if you're in the United States, if you're in Russia, if you're in Australia, Africa. Human nature is human nature. So even though we have our racial issues here in America, not all white people hate black people. Not all black people hate white people or Hispanic people or Asian people. We can get along in this world. And I say that from the experience of my marriage. My husband is a white American. I met him at Purdue University, and we became fast friends. I mean, best friends almost from the beginning. And I won't say, well, not actually from the beginning, only because we actually were both dating different people. But that's another story that my husband tells so well. But I met my husband, and he is my best friend. He's my soulmate, my confidant. And we've been married 30 years now, and it's a blessing to know, to see my own marriage and see that God has blessed me with a man that, I mean, I don't want to say this irreverently, but the saying that he worships the ground that I walk on wouldn't be an understatement.
He treasures you.
Almost insane. He treasures me, yes. And he has shown me that although we can be of different cultural backgrounds, people really are people, and you can love people. You know, when we first were engaged or when we first got married, there were so many people that, oh, they're against interracial marriages or this will never work. But that's not how I find it to be. Now, we do have a different pulse on the race relations in America because of our interracial union, but people are people, and I don't I like to remember that different cultures do things differently, but it doesn't make it wrong or right. Mm-hmm. And judging people just based on a superficial skin tone is what I try to stay away from. Anyone that knows me know I am I'm pro African American, and when I mean that, I cherish being African American and African American female. But I recognize that God has made us all from one blood. We are all His creation, and race, the idea of race, is actually a man-made concept. So God made different languages and tongues and tribes, which created different cultures, but the idea of, you know, this thing of race, that's man-made.
Right. And this points to a kind of a very interesting distinction, and you're doing it in the language of Christian devotion. And that is that, and when you say a person is a person, all human beings, all humanity is the same, that is as much a moral claim as it is an empirical social science-y kind of claim. Mm-hmm. But sometimes the divisions that we impose on each other, we actually begin to live out in the form of hate, or in the form of taking advantage of one another, or being hiding, or not being upfront with each other, or all sorts of or celebrating things that we know others may find offensive, or vice versa. Ways of just kind of getting. We can be ornery.
Yes.
When I hear you say that a person is a person, I hear you acknowledging the full dimension of positive and negative attributes of what it means to be a human.
Mm-hmm.
And because what
when I say people or human nature, when you hurt, it's human nature to cry. Or if we cut ourselves, we will bleed red blood.
Right.
You know, we have fears, we have anxieties. This is human nature, but it can get mixed up with culture,
sure,
and ethnicities, and it can warp into other things.
Well, yeah, and it can be, I mean, if we get hurt by somebody's perceived meanness, we want justice.
Mm-hmm.
And that's also one of those reactions that's just human. Mm-hmm. But then when you layer over that a prejudicial color
mm-hmm.
of justice, then you're in trouble.
Exactly.
Yeah. And
living in Venezuela for 15 years as a missionary showed me, it actually shined a light on our American culture that I might have known on a subconscious level,
mm-hmm.
but you know, when you're out of the country for a length of time and then you come back in, some things are like, oh my goodness, wow.
Yeah. And racism is not absent from Venezuela, but it's not the way it is in the U.S.
It's nothing like the U.S. It's not based on, they have class. So of course there's classism, and they separate by class, but they
and
don't.
There's a color gradient to the classes too, to some extent, is my understanding.
To some extent, but not like it is.
Not
it's
like
nothing here. Like it is. And let me give you an example. When we first moved to Venezuela, and we moved into our home, set it up with our pictures and everything, and Venezuelan friends begin to come over. This, Eric, I kid you not, it was a common question for them to look at the pictures and ask whose parents were Mark's and whose parents were mine, because they weren't looking at a cut. It didn't dawn on them that the people that were light, much lighter hue, light skin, white, right. Americans would be Mark's parents and not mine, or that the dark-skinned people would be my parents and not Mark. They would look at the pictures and want us to, when it first happened, I sort of chuckled thinking they were being funny, but I found out the more it happened that this is not where they draw a line. So
they are not color-coded the way
right.
we have been.
Right.
Yeah. And I'm assuming there were pictures of each one individually, so they didn't know how to put them together.
Right.
Or they didn't have assumptions about how to put them together.
Mm-hmm.
That's beautiful. That's a beautiful story. So 15 years in mission work in Venezuela, what takeaways do you, in addition to the, I mean, most people who go someplace else learn as much or more about where they came from as they do about the place they went to. It's kind of it's another thing about being human is we constantly are measuring and comparing and wondering. Did you get your PhD in history before that trip or after?
Well, my PhD is actually in intercultural studies.
Oh, okay. But you're teaching in
history. But it has a historical slant to it because
sure.
what I did, my PhD dissertation was from a historical perspective of the African-American church and missions. So I delve deep into history. But yes, the PhD is actually intercultural studies.
Sure.
But what I learned living in Venezuela and then coming back to the United States, the what I call the American experiment is an anomaly. A lot of times we as Americans, we have this ethnocentric attitude about how we do things. And we think that this is the way it is, and this is the right way, and this is the only way. And that living in another country, another culture, allows you to come back to the United States and see that this isn't the only way to do things, and it doesn't mean that someone else's way is wrong. And, you know, I've been blessed to travel all over the world. Another funny story from childhood. My parents took us on vacation, and this is actually prior to them taking us to Canada or Mexico. We were in Florida, and we were on one of those excursions, the glass bottom boat excursion. And my father said, the tour guide, I think he said, raise your hand or stand up. All world travelers stand. And Lisa and I stood up. And to this day, my father, he likes telling the story. He says, we prophesied our destiny. We were world travelers at the time, but we are now. But being able to travel the world and see how different cultures operate and different languages and the ethno-linguistic piece to it is, it just reinforces that God created one humanity, right? And we can all get along. I mean, we really could if we tried, but America is an anomaly. The rest of the world is more similar, I think, than we are to the rest of the world, we as Americans.
In terms of openness to others and difference. Mm-hmm. And one of the things that in my own work, we didn't become homogenized until after the Civil War. Because mm-hmm. prior to that, there were socialistic societies, there were lots of different languages. When the United States was founded, German was the dominant language of the majority of the people here. But the Civil War created an occasion where we ended up coming out saying a Pledge of Allegiance. We came out worshiping the flag or worshiping the Confederate flag, depending upon where you were. And none of that happened prior to the Civil War. And we came out completely institutionalized in our local laws, racist laws that hadn't existed prior to the Civil War.
Right, yeah. And actually,
and anti-abortion laws and also and sanitary code laws and the limiting of free speech, all of that stuff happened after the Civil War.
Yeah. Now, as far as the, you know, there were, of course, during slavery, what we call slave codes.
Yes.
And as
yes.
each state, you know, when the Midwestern states began to gain statehood, they adopted because they weren't part of the South and slavery per se. They adopted the Black codes. Yeah.
But there was also a lot of intermarriage, some of it and childbearing, some of it, much of it forced, but some of it voluntary. Extremely complicated.
Yeah, it's a complicated history. And then when you add in the, a lot of times people forget to look at the Native Americans who were here. That's another topic for another day, but the idea that Christopher Columbus would come over and discover something where people had been here for centuries. You know, to think that he would discover something that, you don't discover something that has inhabitants thriving, that whole idea of the Native American and the slavery, and, you know, Native Americans were enslaved. They just, the white European thought it better to have the African. They in their mind, the African was a stronger body and didn't succumb to the sicknesses, or so that prevailed. But the,
right.
that piece of history is usually over, oftentimes, too oftentimes overlooked.
Absolutely. So how do you see, I mean, I'm going to do a quick, you were raised in a family that launched you with as much of a hand grasping the future as one holding in the past, where you could say that I'm a world traveler on that glass boat, but also a family where you were not locked into racial categories, where you didn't happen, you happened to fall in love with a white guy. And you've spent time in Venezuela and you've seen other places. How are all of these observations and experiences shaping the work that you do now and you see yourself doing into the future?
It gives me a perspective for my student that if I had just left Purdue University, pursued my further education, and then went straight into teaching, I don't think it gives your students the well-rounded perspective. I come to the classroom as both a practitioner and a scholar and a researcher, that if I had just gone straight from Purdue University, straight into my master's programs and PhD program, I wouldn't have had the world experience that has shaped who I am and how I view the world, especially in the courses that I teach and the curricula that I write. So it's having been blessed to move around the world and travel and living in Venezuela for nearly 15 years has certainly shaped how I see missions. It shapes how I see education. It shapes how I view each one of my students.
When I talk with you, there's a very measured, deliberative pace, it feels like, to the conversation. It's reflective. Mm-hmm. And when did you learn that skill or that quality, and how do you cultivate it? Because it creates space for multiple perspectives to exist, for one to realize things and to play with them and to not race too fast, but also to not overlook.
Well, I think that goes back to childhood. Growing up in a home with six children, sometimes you feel like, wow, if I don't get it in and get it in quickly, I'm not going to get in. But then other times, there are times where, okay, yeah, let's sit back and let's think through this and let's discuss this. And having five other siblings, that gives you room to cultivate and grow. And then with my husband and I, we love having, I don't know if you call them theological debates or discussions, but we're always having and when we first got married, we were like, I always said, it's funny how we are the same denomination, but it seems like our theology was so far apart, the way he saw things in scriptures and the way I saw things. But just having those regular conversations has taught me personally to stop and take, stand back and listen and look and hear someone else's perspective, because I don't have all the answers. No one person has all the answers. And it does us a disservice to not just think and reflect on not just what we're saying, but listen to what the other person is saying. And that's, too many times people are thinking of what they're going to say next instead of really listening to what the person is saying, especially if it's a discussion where you're on two opposite sides of the discussion.
I hear a lot and take in a lot without reacting to it.
I don't know. I've always been like that, but I have always, now with my family, my siblings and I, we can have those heated emotional debates where
Right,
everybody
right,
begins to
right.
talk at once. But I think also in the I know in the academic arena, if you don't learn to stop and listen, you're not going to go
Right,
too far.
right, right.
And then, of course, even as a Christian, you know, we should be quick to listen. You know, we should be slow to anger. These are things that, while I'm not saying I'm perfect, I'm still striving,
Sure.
but I try my best to use good listening skills. And so on that, I mean, yeah, we our family, it's fun to come in and watch us talk and debate and get heated and everyone talking over each other. But there are times, I mean, when we know, okay, yeah, let's this person, you know, let's slow down and hear what everyone is saying.
Let's cut to music. What should we play next?
Let's listen to Maya Angelou's poem.
Human family. I note the obvious differences in the human family. Some of us are serious. Some thrive on comedy. Some declare their lives are lived as true profundity. And others claim they really live the real reality. The variety of our skin tones can confuse, bemuse, delight. Brown and pink and beige and purple, tan and blue and white. I've sailed upon the seven seas and stopped in every land. I've seen the wonders of the world, not yet one common man. I know 10,000 women called Jane and Mary Jane. I've not seen any two who really were the same. Mirror twins are different, although their features jibe, and lovers think quite different thoughts while lying side by side. We love and lose in China. We weep on England's moors and laugh and moan in Guinea and thrive on Spanish shores. We seek success in Finland, are born and die in Maine. In minor ways we differ, in major we're the same. I note the obvious differences between each sort and type, but we are more alike, my friends, than we are unalike. We are more alike, my friends, than we are unalike. We are more alike, my friends, than we are unalike.
So, Linda, you also wanted to couple this poem with another song. Do you want to say something about the poem, or before we go to the song, or play the song?
Yeah, I really like the Maya Angelou has always been one of my favorites, and I love this poem, and what I like is at the end how she reiterates, "We are more alike, my friends, than we are unalike." And if we approached life like this, I think we could put down some of the barriers and some of the walls that we've built up. But also, I'm an advocate for those who cannot advocate for themselves. That's what we did in Venezuela. I like advocating for children, for the elderly, for those who have been unjustly and unjustly accused. I just like advocating for those who cannot. And this next song, I just always think one day we're going to get to a better place. And that's Ooh Ooh Child. Things are going to get easier.
Of a few beautiful sun. Someday when the world is much brighter. Things will be brighter. Ooh, child, things are gonna be easier. Ooh, child, things will be brighter.
Listening to WRFI, Watkins Glen, Ithaca, and this is the Made of Clay Report. Our guest on this episode is Linda P. Saunders. You made a strong statement about the role of advocacy in your vocation, and then followed it with this real gently drawing out song, assuring us that things are going to get easier. How is it that you do advocacy with that goal in mind?
I think that just goes back to my faith, to faith in God, knowing that He knows the end from the beginning. And while it doesn't always seem like it when we're in our difficult times or during storms, but He's our anchor. The word is my anchor. And so I know that things will get better. And I'm not going to promise that even in this lifetime, but things will get better even if we have to look to, you know, the next lifetime. And when I mean that by, you know, once life is over here, God has promised us that, that, you know, there's a better mm-hmm. place that He's prepared. And so having an anchor in God, an anchor in the Word, that's the perspective that from which I'm coming.
Yeah. Right. And I want to model back to you some, or share back to you some language that many of the listeners to my show are people who are don't have a religious practice, aren't religious, may even find religion offensive or spiritual practice or offensive. One way that I can hear what you just said is that your faith gives a structure for your suffering. Mm-hmm. You're not just alone. You're not just responding or huddling with this small group who cannot somehow change the circumstances immediately, but may have to look to a structure that gives some sense of direction, some patience, some bigger picture, and this is where you find it in your Christian faith.
Yes.
It's not a promise of a pie in the sky. It's not a promise of a happy ending. It may be a really terrible ending for you, and wonderful things happen. And then, as you believe in the resurrection, there may be something more for you that you can't even imagine. Mm-hmm. But that's not like living for a fantasy. It's living trusting that there's a structure there.
Right. Yes. Yes.
That your suffering and your work is meaningful, even if it's relentless.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. There's hope.
There's hope. Right. And there, okay. Yes. And hope is not an object out there. Hope is the stance that we take to be open to what we can do now, knowing that it's long beyond our lives. That is not the hope in things in the future, the hope of things that you could name. It's the hope of something that you don't know, but you could not live otherwise.
Right, exactly.
Yeah, and that's many people I'm learning don't understand hope in that way. They confuse hope with optimism about an outcome.
Yeah, and it's not the same at all.
At all, at all, at all. I want to switch the topic now to what I'd like to close the show with. And how do you take care of yourself emotionally, intellectually, physically, and spiritually throughout the day, daily, weekly, monthly? What do you do, and how do you know you need to do it?
Well, starting with the physical part, I eat a balanced diet. About 4 years ago, I cut sugar out of my diet. I was consuming sugar like an addict, really.
Uh-huh.
And I decided to just go cold turkey, and I didn't know if I could do that, but I did. So cool. I took sugar out of my diet. Once again, harkening back to my parents, we were raised on a balanced diet. We always had some kind of green vegetable and salads and then the protein, so either meat or beans, but we were raised on a balanced diet, and to this day, I think it's still what my body craves. I do very little. I don't like fast food, and when we're traveling, sometimes we might fall into it where we have to, you know, grab something quickly, but I try my best to do balanced diets all the time. Mm-hmm. Walking is always good, but Mark and I, we go into these spurts where we'll walk and then we'll sort of slack off. intellectually, I'm an avid reader. And when I say avid reader, I consume books. I love
you inhale them.
And it's what I've done since it's all my life. It's all I've known. I still can think of stories that my father read us. He would read to us our bedtime stories. And I remember him reading Dr. Doolittle, Talking to the Animals. And, I remember asking him to, you know, read it again. So I don't know how old I was.
Daddy, read it again.
So, you know, reading has always been a huge part of my life. I love playing board games. Mm-hmm. So especially word games. I like to think that I'm good. I am competitive, so.
I never would have guessed that.
But I find actually word games are relaxing for me.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, when the kids come over, Mark and I, we have 5 adult children and 3 grandbabies. And when any of them come, whether they're all here at once or individually, they know that I want to play a game. So that's what growing up with the kids, Thursday night was game night. And we just would play we would rotate, and everyone would have a chance to choose their board game that we would play that evening. So that was fun. Emotionally, of course, back to my spiritual life, I lean on God. I pray. I read my Bible, have my devotion times. That's important. Mm-hmm. It's not just for spiritual health, but for my emotional health. Mm-hmm. Because I do believe God is the center of what I do, of my life.
Right.
And then also Mark is my confidant. And I can't reiterate that enough. As far as in this world, in this life, Mark is my confidant. We talk, I like to say in some senses he keeps me grounded, and in some ways I keep him grounded, but we're still, to this day, we're still best friends, and it's a wonderful thing.
I'm seeing that very clearly when you smile and when you tell that story. Linda, it's been really good to get to know you. What would you like to close the show with musically?
Musically, I'd like to close it with a piece by Ray Bolts called Thank You for Giving to the Lord. And the reason, when we think about it, well, for me, life is a vapor. That's what the Bible tells us. And only what you do for Christ will last. There was a plaque on the inside the Indianapolis Library downtown. As you left the building, the old building, I know they've remodeled, but it said, time by minutes ticks away, first the hour, then the day. Small the daily loss appears, yet it soon amounts to years. Time is fleeting, and I know we always get, 24 hours in a day and 7 days in a week and 365 days in a year, but time is fleeting. And what I want my legacy, if I was to say a legacy, I want it to be that I gave for the cause of Christ. So thank you for giving to the Lord.
Thank you.
You were there with me. We walked upon the streets of gold beside the crystal sea. We heard the angels singing, and someone called your name. We turned and saw this young man, and he was smiling as he came. He said, friend, you may not know me now. And then he said, but wait, you used to teach my Sunday school when I was only 8. And every week you would say a prayer before the class would start. And one day when you said that prayer, I asked Jesus in my heart. Lord, I am a life that was changed. Thank you for giving to the Lord. I am so glad you gave. Then another man stood before you. Said, remember the time a missionary came to your church. His pictures made you cry. You didn't have much money, but you gave it anyway. Jesus took the gift you gave, and that's why I'm here today. Lord, I am a life that was changed. Thank you for giving to the Lord. I am so glad you gave. One by one they came. as the eye could see. Each life somehow touched by your generosity. Little things that you had done, sacrifices made, I noticed on the earth, in heaven now proclaimed. I know up in heaven you're not supposed to cry, but I am almost sure there were tears in your eyes as Jesus took your hand and you stood before the Lord. He said, my child, look around you, for great is your reward. Thank you for giving to the Lord. For I am a life that was changed. Thank you for giving to the Lord. I am so glad you came. I am a life that was changed. Thank you for giving to the Lord. I am so glad. So